Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen over here in Studio A, and Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, it's getting cold. I pulled out my winter sweaters today. What about you?
Yeah, well, that's almost what you got to do, but the temperature's supposed to be back up in the lower 70s and the 60s. The key will, you know, be the wind has reduced itself and if we get a little sunshine. So, you know, what the heck, this is Minnesota. It's now late September, if you will. You know, I've seen snow come in October, man, you know, so you can't tell what it's going to be, but it's all a part of Minnesota. But what we got, Don?
Well, you know,
we're going an hour and a half tonight, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
You know,
you sound to be able,
yes,
you seem to be a little distant from the microphone there. I don't know, you may want to hold up a little closer to you, man.
This might be a little bit
flavor, but go ahead on, man. We have a guest, and let's see, why don't you introduce him and rock and roll.
Okay, yeah, and we're glad to have Mr. Lenny Chisholm with us tonight. He's done some work with the city of Minneapolis to kind of make it accessible for contractors with different services to collaborate and actually get contracts with the city of Minneapolis. Unlike Mr. Edwards, my contract with the Council on Black Minnesotans, which just got an invoice in today from work I've done since April. But anyway, that's a whole other story. We'll get into that one day. But welcome, mm-hmm. Mr. Lenny Chisholm. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, guys? I'm doing pretty fair.
How's it going?
And I ain't wearing no,
hey,
I ain't wearing no big coat yet, man.
Yeah. I know how that is. Neither am I. I mean, I'm wearing big sweaters, but not no big coats. So, Lenny, I saw some posts on Facebook about some contract rearrangements that Elizabeth Glidden wrote a very shining narrative with your name plastered all over the place, and I didn't really, you know, understand. A couple of people called me and asked me, so, well, I said the best thing to do is call up Lenny, get him on the show, and let you explain it. So can you explain it to us, please, sir?
Well, you know, I appreciate you reading that fine, glaring post. I was surprised she put it out there, and the rest of y'all probably were too. The situation with the City of Minneapolis and their contracting has always been a problem. It has not been resolved it's always been a problem. Every disparity study has been a problem, and there's never been any fixes for it. One of the things that came out of the last 2 years has been all the data that's been compiled that shows that Minnesota is by far treating its people of color, particularly African Americans, worse financially, wealth-wise, sustainability-wise, than almost everywhere in the country, including Mississippi. And those statistics have now created an environment where they have to try to do something because of the black eyes that they're getting in across the country. They can no longer go in a room and say, well, we're the nice place to live, and we have a Minnesota nice environment, and African Americans do extremely well here, and people of color do extremely well. Well, the data does not support any of that notion. In fact, the most recent one says that African Americans are getting, their wealth is $32,000 per year, and that's the bottom of all ethnic groups, and the Asians are at $72,000 per year. They've had an increase, and we've had an actual decrease in our wealth, as reported by the Star Tribune. Now, given those as a backdrop, one of the things that the city of Minneapolis does is it's an economic engine. It collects its taxes from everyone. If you ever buy anything in the city of Minneapolis beyond food, you're going to pay a tax. And you guys are familiar mm-hmm. with that, because if you buy, I mean, we're talking anything besides food and clothing is another one I think of. Depends on what food item it is, you may not pay a tax on it. But food and clothing are the two items that aren't taxed. But everything else, hospitality, if you go and stay in a hotel, you drink some liquor, you buy something at the restaurants, you pay taxes. So the city is a huge engine, and they also get a ton of money from the people in, I call it the state of Minnesota, from Hennepin County and so on. So what happened is that the taxes collected were not being redistributed in a fashion that people could of color were able to get them, because they put a couple rules in place, and then they hired some good color gals and guys called the Office of Civil Rights to administer those rules, and those rules were basically to put put there to basically keep you from getting money and telling you, well, this is why you're not getting it, because of the rules. So given that we are not a group of people who believe in going down there asking for economic opportunities, we generally go down for social reasons. As a small business person, I had no desire to go down and deal with the Office of Civil Rights. They don't bring solutions. They administer the program. So I said, well, we need to look at this. And then a friend of mine brought me, he was bidding on contracts. And he was losing the people in California. He was losing the people in New York. It didn't make a difference. He's always losing these contracts with the city of Minneapolis. And the Office of Civil Rights was setting zero goals on these contracts. He's selling commodities. He's selling widgets, bolts, nuts, lights, whatever. And I said, how can this be occurring when there's an Office of Civil Rights that's supposed to be setting goals? Well, it turns out the Office of Civil Rights sets no goals on commodities, none. And the only way that they set goals on contracting is when it goes through and is awarded through a third party. So if it's not awarded through a contract that goes through a general contractor, there's no goals. We have absolutely nothing set. So then that's the problem. So then I went out and I met with the head of the Office of Civil Rights, and they basically said, well, there's nothing we're going to do for you. Absolutely nothing. Zero. I said, well, wait a minute. Aren't you the people who are supposed to advocate for us? Well, we know what the answer for that is, and you guys have detailed that on many shows, so I won't go into that. And the answer basically came back, go find somebody else. Make us do something. Tell them to tell us to do something, otherwise we're not going to do it for you. So fine.
Wow.
So as any person in it who believes that we have to show up to be heard, to get on the menu instead of being on the table, I went and said, hey, this isn't going to be instant coffee. It's going to take a while. So about 3 years ago, right when the change of leadership happened at the city council, I went in along with some others and said, we'd like to redo the contracting and procurement processes that go on for small businesses. That was the key, and that is the key, to dealing with the contracting issues, is that because of the way that the white businesses were being kept out of the contracting was because the larger corporations had went in and wrote the rules in such a way that they were direct benefits of the contracting, and even the smaller businesses were not doing as well under the contracting rules, the procurement rules. So what we did, we said, let's look at the other cities.
Edwards, are you there?
I'm right here.
You just dropped out. Okay, you just dropped out for a minute.
Okay.
But yeah, keep going, please, because this is very interesting.
So what I said was, let's look at the other cities where this has been a problem. And I said, they have size standards for purchasing from small businesses. It's an informal process so that the small businesses are not always cut out of the deals. And what they did was they put them together, and they said, we want to size standard these businesses so that only the contracts for this size will go to this size business. And we're going to leave the big guys out of the equation. Now, that didn't go over very well, naturally, because the big guys wanted to keep all their money. And they were getting all of the money day in and day out. So what we did was we said, let's not go through the Office of Civil Rights for this. That's not the standard process, because most people go down and go through the Office of Civil Rights. I said, I'm a small business. The Office of Civil Rights hasn't done anything for me ever. I mean, ever. So why bother going over trying to deal with them? They're not business people. They're administrators. Let's look at how the businesses would go over and get contracts. And based on that, is how we started the conversation. And it took 3 years before we got to the passage of the conversation to get into a law, an ordinance. 3 years.
Hmm.
I met with Delmer Corbell. I met with every council member down there, Elizabeth Glidden, Barb Johnson, John Quincy, Long Yang, you name it. I met with all of them at the city of Minneapolis. And I kept meeting with them. I didn't stop meeting with them. I kept meeting with them because at the end of the day, I realized that the only way that this was going to happen is that you stayed in their face. Why give them a break? What's the point? You already have nothing, so you might as well keep showing up. And then all of these things started coming out within the last 2 years. That is what helped this passage of this ordinance, was that so many other things were starting to come out as well. You know, you start seeing that the city of Minneapolis isn't helping their black people, their Mexican people, their Hispanic people. All of these things go into play in helping to pass laws. You just have to have been down there long enough to get it done. Then the disturbance over north with the 4th Precinct helped as well. So now we have something called the Target Market Program that I suggested 3 years ago. They finally are thinking of putting it together. And when I say thinking of putting it together, they don't have all the rules for it yet. But here's the thing that's beautiful about it. They don't have all the rules for it yet. So we still have to go down there. We still have to go and argue for our position on the table. And that's where the battle goes on, because the only thing the city of Minneapolis can do for people is provide services. And those services are provided by either the staff or contracts. Well, if you can't get the city of Minneapolis to support the small businesses, then the larger corporations such as the Medtronics, the Hewlett Packards, Northwest Airlines, and so on, they have a global mission that they have to accomplish. So the small business is the one that drives the jobs in the local area. So why give all the money to the large businesses? Figure out a way to give the small businesses. And the thing that the reason this bill works so well and can work so well for minority businesses, what are we? For the African-American businesses, what are we? We're small businesses. We're not generationally wealth enhanced, so we automatically come out to shoot as large businesses. Most of us are first generation. So whether the legislation was written for white small businesses or black small businesses, it was just written for small businesses. And that's how we can really compete to get this money, because if we're trying to develop the Civil Rights Department to help us with race-specific goals, they do that with hiring. They do that with the people that they bring inside of the city of Minneapolis. Well, we got 10 people in the department. Let's make one of them black, one of them Asian, one of them Hispanic, one of them maybe Somalian. But they don't say, well, we're going to make this contractor. That's not part of the deal. So that's what I think was the driving factor in getting this ordinance put in the books of the city of Minneapolis, is that we have to support the small businesses, more of all small businesses, because if we don't, well, who's going to do the hiring for the people that they don't want to hire? Big government hires so many people, and after that, there's not too many more of those they're going to hire in the departments. That's in essence what this whole thing is about.
Let me ask you a question.
To get too long-winded for you guys.
No. That's good information, but I want to ask you a question now. Now, the small businesses that they engage, I know it's a contract up to $100,000, if I'm not mistaken, and are those also for soft services? Are you talking about, like, maybe garbage removal, contracts for restoration, street stuff that the cleanup or the city that the city contracts with in all areas, or is it just in one basic area, or they don't know, they haven't gotten that far?
Your last part of it answered it. They haven't gotten that far yet.
Oh,
they've created a general framework. When I asked people, you know, I did a point plan where I wanted them to go. I wanted mine to be a lot more specific than they actually had. I wanted it to be tailored for the people who are actually offer businesses in the city of Minneapolis, I wanted them to get a price preference because we pay city of Minneapolis property taxes, where if you live in Anoka, you don't pay the city of Minneapolis property taxes. You know, that's not covered, you know. So my bid has to cover the city of Minneapolis property taxes in it. And those are the things that they are still have to put into this small business procurement program called the Target Market Program.
Okay.
And that's why it's important that we don't leave the table, we stay at the table, because those are the things that we're really fighting for. We're fighting to make sure that if a business is located in North Minneapolis, well, we know that's a high poverty range, high poverty area. So why wouldn't that business be given a preference as a small business, not as a black business or a Hispanic business or Asian business? Or it's not given that preference. It's saying because of the poverty in the area, if that business is located there, we can maybe give that a price preference. Because I may only buy 50 widgets, and the company above me may buy 400 widgets because they're servicing Edina, which is still part of Hennepin County. So the rules of the program are not in place, but yet we have to go out there and fight for that same privilege. So if my business is located in North Minneapolis, and there's a poverty in North Minneapolis, there's very few retail spaces in North Minneapolis, there are very few warehouse spaces in North Minneapolis, all of that has to be put there. And so thus, I'm going to be one of the small businesses that create that opportunity. I need to have a price preference to hire from within North Minneapolis, where they typically say the workforce is not as educated or well-equipped as the workforce in Edina.
No, I was saying on that point, I'm sure you had the support of agencies like the Minneapolis Urban League and the Stair Step Foundation, and I mean, they must be applauding you for this business move at this point. What was the feedback, or did you get any feedback at all from those agencies?
Shall I sound like, you know, I'm going to sound like a cricket for you, Don. You know,
okay.
Can I sound like a cricket?
Yes, you did. Okay. All right.
Hey, man.
And you know what? I'm glad I got you on, Lee, because this is the point. This is my point on asking you that, because it was a rhetorical question. I think I heard Mr. Edwards snickering back there a little bit. But, you know, this thing is like, you know, the Urban League had the gateway to opportunity, except the gate was always locked. And there was no one on either side of the gate with a key. So there was just a gateway with no opportunity, actually. And something like this, you know, it's the beginning, and you have the opportunity kind of to mold it in a direction where it does become an opportunity. And I just thought it was a really good thing to have you on the show to talk about this. Mr. Edwards, do you have any questions?
Oh, yeah, yeah. A couple things with regards to what is being said. First of all, Don, you and I well remember a meeting about 3 years ago, real cold night, down at the old, in fact, probably almost 4 years ago, because it was at the old Humphrey Dome, if you will. A real cold night. I remember you raised a number of questions about veterans and such things as that, which is certainly important. And I remember the little controversy broke out, and the Velma Corvell that was referred to by the caller gave some bad information and then lied. But you sent a video to a very powerful city councilman who is no longer on the council. He retired. And I remember he called her into his office. She continued to lie. He showed her the video. And I well remember, because let me ask this question. I have just a serious question. Whatever happened to the race neutral? And because I'm going to go back into this information that you're talking about with regards to designating geographical areas. But what happened to the race neutral concept that city government had that was in play 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago?
Well, Mr. Edwards, I'm going to say to you, man, it's you know, I ain't trying to be funny, man, but I think I'd have a better chance finding Jimmy Hoffa. You know, it's going to be real.
In what context? With finding Jimmy Hoffa in what regards to the question?
I don't know who kidnapped it, where it went, where it goes, how you,
oh,
get,
you, mean
it, how
the,
you get it.
You mean neutral, race neutral?
Yeah, I don't know what that race neutral stuff is. I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea, man.
Based on that question, let me then ask you this. Who, number one, why don't you give us the identification and the number of the new ordinance that has been passed? Well, what is it? I mean, 165.75. I mean, what is the number so we can make reference to it in the remainder of this program? What is the ordinance?
Well, you know, actually, I don't know the reference number because it's called the Target Market Program, TMP. And if you Google, when you go to the City of Minneapolis procurement. When you go to the City of Minneapolis procurement page, it has a link that says new program on that page.
So
who is the
administrator? Who's going to be the administrator? Who's going to have responsibility? Who's in the hot seat? Give us some names. You mentioned Velma Corbell. We all know she's the director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, which controls contract compliance and et cetera. So who is it over in contract compliance that it will be the person that will be held responsible for the success of this this new version of inclusion?
Nobody.
Nobody?
Mm. Nobody. The person that this remember, as far as let me bring you back to the first part of the conversation. First part of the conversation said this did not go through the Office of Civil Rights. This went through the
procurement
department.
Well, I understand that, and that's the reason I crafted my question to say who will be responsible. So give me the name of who is it. Is there a new office of contract compliance? Because it is a contract.
No. The chief financial officer under the city controller is responsible for the target market program.
Oh, the city controller, I see. And so the city controller now has people involved in contract compliance. Is that right?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, just what I said. The communications get bad here. So the controller, the office of the controller for Minneapolis City Government now has a section in their office that it identifies with contract compliance. So is there a person?
Well,
it
has
there
a person
that
that's supposed to be. It has two people that's supposed to be the equity liaison people. One of them is named George Marsh Stevens, and I can't think of the second person's name at this time.
Julianne Learson.
Yeah, that's the person. Yep, that's the person. Yeah. And so
came to us from our the hub, if I'm not mistaken, right? Okay,
yeah.
So she had a history at the hub of being involved in contract compliance and facilitation of contracts and meetings. Some kind of goal. Okay, gotcha. Okay.
And then they hired a new. They also hired a new chief financial officer. They got the other guy that was there before. He's no longer there. So the target market program is going through the chief financial officer.
Yeah.
And
okay.
He's part of the. He's under the
city coordinator.
Controller's office. Yeah, I'm sorry,
under the
coordinator's
office
yeah.
or the city coordinator?
Under the
and
coordinator,
they all
city,
to coordinator's
city coordinator. Yep, they all report to city
coordinator.
Okay,
so the
there's an org chart. Ron, let me also clarify. I have not gotten the org chart and don't know if it's been updated or not for any of the changes. I'm going by what was previously there.
Oh, okay.
And
okay,
that's
so when's the last
time
you guys met? Because you say you've been battling with this for, what, 3 years? Okay.
3 years. Go ahead.
When was the last time you met? I mean, your group met, and when was this voted on by the city council?
It just was approved on, I think, on the 21st of the month.
September?
Last week, yep, 21st
of
September.
Okay, so that's already been published. Me and Mr. Allen should be able to call it up on our computers,
but it will also tell you that none of the rules are in place yet for the ordinance. That still has to be created.
So
when are the public hearings slated
to happen? Are there dates for the public
hearing? It's already done. It's done.
When did it take place, and when was the notification?
The notification was on the 21st. They approved it through the city council as a whole.
But when did they make notification? Under the city charter, you got to give 60-90 days before anything is confirmed. So when were the sometime this past summer?
I presume,
Under what city council committee?
Under the Ways and Means Committee.
under Councilman Blong Yang. Okay.
John Quincy.
Then we get Blong
no,
Yang.
No, 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 not Blong Yang. John Quincy. I think he's the one over the Ways and Means.
Oh, Ways and Means. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the Ways and Means Committee held public hearings on this, and people came in and gave testimony and et cetera. Is that right?
I'm going to make an assumption and say yes.
Well, did you attend? Did you go?
I didn't attend. I always sent mine over through via emails. I always sent any correspondence I had through emails.
Oh,
so I kept my correspondence always.
Okay.
So because I don't have time nor the resources to go down there and try to keep track of every time they have a meeting
at
City Hall.
Now, Elizabeth Glidden, you said helped you put together the kind of the strategy and kind of helped shepherd this through the city council. Is that correct?
She did not put together she didn't help me put together a strategy. No, I started meeting with Councilmember Glidden because she had as I met with all the council members, I went to their office hours. She was the first one I approached about the target market program because she had the best office hours to always connect with her.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, and the fact that she had some good, found a way.
So if we looked in the journal and commercial paper and et cetera, we would be able to find out at what point. See, I'm like Mr. Allen, my associate. I'm trying to figure out what of the big civil rights leaders came down and supported this new approach. I mean, Mr. Allen asked earlier in this program, did the Urban League come down? Did some of the Ministerial Alliance come down? Who came down to support it?
You know, as far as I know, I don't keep track of every meeting that goes on in City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
None of them.
None of them came down. Okay.
So I can't, I can't emphatically say they haven't, but I can only say that they were not willing to talk with me.
You say there are a couple people already in place. Mr. Allen has named one of them. You named the other one. They're in place. They're going to start overseeing. I use that word. They're going to start overseeing the implementation and the adherence. This is important as far as I'm concerned, the adherence to the letter of the law. So that will be their responsibility. Is that right?
According to my documentation, which is out of the ordinance, yes. Because
your
what they have to do
is out of the ordinance. Oh, okay.
Out of the ordinance. Because according to
Mr.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
no,
go ahead, Don. What you got?
Chisholm. I found the program start date. They got a Q&A sheet on the City of Minneapolis website here. It says, when will the program begin? It says the goal is to pass the ordinance late summer or fall, which she did, effective date January 1st, 2017. It says, how is it different from the city's small business and underutilized business program? And the answer to that is, which is something that you were looking for, Mr. Edwards, the Target Market Program, TMP, is a race and gender-neutral program. Unlike
that's why we raised the question.
Underutilized business program that focuses specifically on minority and women-owned businesses. The TMP is intended to level the playing field for all small businesses in the name. Hallelujah. Yeah, so, that's there on their site. They
all right, reason I asked the question, gentlemen, I want to continue to examine this. I'm looking here at my studio, Don. I'm looking at a report from the state of Minnesota. Governor Mark Dayton's Diversity and Inclusion Council report to Governor Mark Dayton, January 2016. Mm-hmm. And we talked about that and dealt with that on this program. And it has some rather interesting numbers with regards to where money was going, where money wasn't going. And, of course, we talked about this almost a year ago because African Americans and veterans certainly got shut out. In fact, African Americans were at about, in 2015, actual spending, FY, $135,000 out of $73,560,000, a total of $1,713,463,144. So we've been seeing these numbers. You know, numbers look great. Well, the rhetoric sounds great, and then what happens? The numbers come out, and black folk ain't nowhere to be found. So that's the reason I was asking the question, gentlemen, who will have the statutory authority to, if there is not a consistency with application and success, that the persons in question will run down from the controller's office and report to the Ways and Means Committee and to the Finance Chair and et cetera that there is a problem. And so then I wonder who will handle the consequences? Will the council call in the principal protectors, if you will, of the law and ask them why this isn't working? Because I know over many, many years I've seen this happen time and time and time again, and I'm not new to it, and legal action has been taken and all those kinds of things. Let me ask this. Why would some of the council members continue to support, maybe you're not in a position, Lenny, to answer this, why would they continue to support the incumbency of Velma Corvell, who actually still handles contract compliance for the city of Minneapolis? Why would they continue to support her and give her term after term after term with this kind of miserable record that you first talked about at approximately, 8:32? Was there any discussion with the council members about any dissatisfaction with the absence of success of the Civil Rights Department? Or was that just something?
I didn't hold my tongue on that one. When I went down there, I told them, I said, y'all hired her. Y'all hired her to administer a program, and you told her how to administer it.
You've been
and
telling
so
them that for the last 3 years? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I said, I'm not going to go down here and try to, I just need to get you away from dealing with her, which successfully we did. We were able
to get away from dealing with her?
The city council away from trying to run all of our needs through the Office of Civil Rights.
Okay.
This wasn't making any sense. It just didn't. It didn't add up.
All right.
But I'm going down there.
Try to get Ms. Lawson in here, and let's try to see if we can find somebody in addition. And man, we may try to have him on the program over the next couple of weeks, because we've been on for a half hour with Mr. Chisholm, and this is additional news, if you will. Looks like a new approach to an age-old problem. I was looking at, Lenny, you talked in terms of identifying by geographical areas. And I remember 3 years ago, Jesus Christ, Don, it's been a long time. 3 years ago, we talked about this, and at that time, the state was the overseer. Don't you remember, gentlemen, when we saw that same kind of language for the depressed areas of North Minneapolis, remember, Don, by zip codes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it was called the Empowerment Zone at one point. I mean, it's got all kind of different names. It's been used.
No,
I'm
not talking about the Empowerment Zone. It wasn't the Empowerment Zone in the. I'm referring, sir, from the legislation dealing with the U.S. Bank Stadium. Now, the Empowerment Zone was way back in the early 2000s and the late.
Well, you're right about that, man.
Yeah, I know I am.
Well, Ron.
Cool.
We've got to continue to try new different ways.
Open doors. No doubt about it.
As a small business person, man, I walk in, I've been listening to the same rhetoric for 20 years, and they send me over to that office.
Yeah, I've been listening to it for 40, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Try
something different.
Yeah.
This is what we have to do.
All right. Well, Mr. Allen and I are going to try to get some of these principals in here who are individuals who are expected to now facilitate success, if you will, and kind of give us an overview of what their approach will be administratively, procedurally, legally.
Hey, keep me in the loop, man. Let me know what they say. I'll be happy to listen to it.
We'll run it through Elizabeth Glidden's office. She can get in touch and
right.
et cetera. But hey, I appreciate it, man. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Lenny.
All right. Okay.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you. That's Lenny Chisholm on the line with us, explaining the city of Minneapolis and what they got going on. Wow, that's a lot of information, Mr. Evers. That's a lot of information. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing about Julianne. Is it Julianne Lawson? How she pronounced that last name, Donald?
Julianne Learson.
Learson used to be up at the Hub. See, I've been in meetings with her for the last year. And she had a different role that she said she was bringing to the table with the federal oversight group, the Department of Justice. Oops. And you know, I just didn't get the feel that she was talking about anything having to do with, you know, contracts and business and et cetera. But I'm fascinated by how we're going to do it once again by geographical area, the you know, the north side. I guess that's to keep folks on the north side pumped up and fired up that something's going to finally happen as they're being pushed out of the north side, pushed out of their apartments, and et cetera. But let's make a commitment, Don, here tonight to get Julie Ann to agree to come on next mm-hmm. Wednesday and walk us through what her thinking is and what her plan of action is and et cetera, because there were some things that Lenny seemed to be a little light on as it pertains to what was going to specifically happen. And we need to take a look and find out if we can – when were the public hearings? Because okay. I'm just a little bit taken back by the fact that with all the heavy hitters, and particularly with some indicating that a $35 million economic package came into the African-American community, I'm trying to figure out how that should have been incorporated into this. You know what I'm saying, Don?
Oh, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. And that, you know, you had just said something, Mr. Edwards, about the let me just find here, the state of Minnesota, I mean, and the Governor Dayton's inclusion.
Yes, yes. We're looking at it in studio. I'm waving it at you now.
Okay.
Governor Mark Dayton's Diversity and Inclusion Council report to Governor Mark Dayton, dated January 2016. And very interesting, and the numbers are really interesting because in a program back in January of this year, we were really blasting the Democrats and anybody else with regards to the numbers that talk in terms of and remember they also talked about the certifying and certification of TGs,
yes.
EDs, and VDs. You remember that?
Yeah.
And we were looking at the number of certified businesses because my understanding is if you don't have a certified business, small, big, medium, whatever else, you're not going to be eligible for any monies that are state monies or federal monies. And that's where the city gets its money from.
Well, when you get a chance, check out the first name on page 30, and I will talk about that after the show because I have it up in front of me. I'm looking on page 30, and this is something we talked about in production meeting, but I don't want to let the cat out of the bag just yet. But that name is the first name.
Hold just a minute because we want page 30. Okay, what line, Donald?
It's community participant. It has the participant's name and the organization. And I'm looking at the first name and the participant under on page 30. 29, Wednesday, July 1st, 2015, the date, and it says community stakeholders and meeting results shown.
All right, this is on page 30 of the document identified as the January 2016 document presented to the governor of the state of Minnesota, because I'm looking at page 30 also, and
okay,
I have it here in front of
that,
me. Now, I see a whole list of names. Don, are you talking about the committee members?
Yeah, the specifically the Northside Funders Group and the Minneapolis Foundation.
Yeah, because see, that would be on page 29 of the document I have, and that particular group,
okay.
If you will, yeah, and there's a whole group of people there, and the Northside Funders Group, I guess they're somewhere around there. That's what I basically see as I go to page 130. In fact, they make reference to the July 1st, 2015 report identifying several goals to accomplish before the January 2016 Diversity and Inclusion Report, and that is interesting and et cetera. So you want to get in a little discussion at some point on the Northside providers. Now, this is the group that includes our good friend, our Louis King, and some of that crew.
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Some of that crew, Mr. Ezell Jones.
Yeah, okay.
And until the person that heads the group.
Gotcha. I will remember
I'm to connect.
The discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm
lines, man. Maybe there's a couple people out there, M or some others may want to call in. But I think it would have been good if we can find somebody who testified at the public hearing before the Finance Committee, before the Ways and Means Committee, and what kind of recommendations and et cetera. See, I just don't agree that you can knock out the Civil Rights Department, because the Civil Rights Department is the enforcement arm under the charter of the city of Minneapolis. The Comptroller's Office is not an enforcement entity, okay? All the Comptroller's Office can do based on current policy is to make a recommendation if something is going wrong, and the only place that something be going wrong with them is how much interest they're getting on your money. Well, you live in Columbia.
Bingo.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So, hey, this is interesting, good information, and we gave the gentleman a half hour to kind of lay it out and talk about what he had done for the – and, boy, that was a hard task, 3 years. Wow.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's a lot of –
In fact, here's a question I would like to ask. Was the city's civil rights director, who has statutory authority over contract compliance, was she asked to testify? You wonder about that. See if you can see anything on your computer with regards to was she asked to testify, and if she did, what day did she testify? Or was she ever questioned by the Ways and Means Committee and the City Council? You know what I'm saying, Don?
Yeah.
Because she's the keeper of the watch, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
You got to go back and take a look at who's got the enforcement authority, okay? Because that's one of the things that came out in the report, both by the legislative committee when they told that story 3.5 years ago, that all them black folks was going to go to work over there in them zip codes, you know what I mean, up down that north side. They were all going to have jobs down there on the stadium. See, people tend to play like they don't remember all that, okay? But that is in the legislative statute that created, quote-unquote, everything that is now being absorbed by the U.S. Bank Stadium, if you will, making a lot of money down there. But man, they're making so much money down there. They tell me my good friend Louis King is averaging $250,000 on his chicken wings at his concession stand and at his little automobile cart outside the stadium. Man, making a lot of money, man. And then right behind him is our good friend the Reverend Clarence Hightower.
Oh, man, cleaning up down there. You know, well, they found
man,
work.
They make
they
so much money.
They definitely found work.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Hey, our phone lines are open. It's 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. If you want to call in and have a question, talk about anything, the debate or anything like that.
There you go, the debate. Yeah. Let me say one other thing, because we want to get the information in. We got plenty of time. One of the things that maybe Alex Tittle and them need to take a look at is that they need to start paying their vendors. Oops.
Mm.
You know they haven't paid their vendors. We weren't really supposed to tell this because it was given to us kind of in a security confidence way. Did you know they haven't paid their vendors down there, man?
Mm.
Don't all that beer and stuff like that, man. You got to pay your people. That's why they had a job fair yesterday, I think it was. Ooh, again, we wasn't supposed to tell this. They had a job fair yesterday because they have already lost like 400 to 500 people.
Come on, Alex, and
you guys down there, and our good friend, the chairwoman. You know, you gotta pay your people. You know, you tout the fact that you're hiring all these community people at, you know, less than $15 an hour, but you at least gotta pay them. I mean, my God.
Yeah,
you know, sure I mean?
Do. Hey, and Mr. Edwards, we have a special caller that's calling
in live.
Let's get the caller in.
Yeah, okay. Come on,
caller, you live on the air. Who's calling? Let's have it. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello.
Yes.
Hello, my name.
Hello, sir.
Yeah.
You're live.
Yeah. I didn't want to change the subject too much. I just wanted to kind of ask a question, Mr. Edwards.
You went
to Syracuse. Is that correct?
University of Syracuse.
University,
that's right.
Yeah,
in the mid-1960s. Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to know if you were familiar with the a book called The Man Who Cried I Am.
Yes, I am very much so.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering if you could.
I mean, we've talked before, but what was the reason for your inquiry, sir?
Well, I just wanted to understand some of your history, surrounding some of the stuff that was going on in the 60s. I just thought that was kind of interesting, particularly the subject of internment, of not only the possible of internment of African Americans and others that might be. Yeah, because
yeah,
I just wanted to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the book, The Man Who Cried I Am, which was written by a very well-known author who, of course, is not identified by white critics, John A. Williams. The book actually was started in 1964 and was copyrighted, sir. I think I got a communication from one of your people late this afternoon indicating that that question would be asked. I didn't know if you were going to be able to get through. Now I recognize, well, I realize who you probably are, sir. The book was copyrighted in 1964. It disappeared, if I can say it like that, in the late 1960s. Did not reappear again until actually it was 1967 that it was actually copyrighted, and then it was recopyrighted, or what is called after forward, in 2004. In fact, the book that I was able, I initially had an original signed by Mr. Williams because of our relationships and working together, along with the only two black members of the United States Congress at that time, the Honorable Reverend Adam Clayton Powell Jr., Democrat of New York, Harlem, and William Dawson of the South Side of Chicago. But yes, The Man Who Cried I Am is a book which deals with confidential documentation, plans, and et cetera for the internment of African Americans, much of it shaped and crafted on the plan that was used to incarcerate and intern the Japanese Americans, Nishi, as they were called, in February of 1942 after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But that was a forerunner of a plan that was actually developed by the Bureau of Investigation in 1922, later to be called the Federal Bureau of Investigation by one J. Edgar Hoover. The Japanese historians have, over the years, reflected on the fact that actually it was the Japanese Navy's intelligence unit, which was the best of the branches of service of the Japanese Imperial Army. And actually, there's a kind of a story there, and I shared that with your people earlier today, in which it was the Japanese who at 1922, 23, 24 were not considered to be hostile per se to the United States, who had kind of discovered and uncovered a plan. And what they began to do is reach out to the Negro community of that particular period, particularly the grandfather of a man by the name of Martin Luther King Jr., and began to share information with the Negro community. In fact, there was a lot of discussion during the so-called Renaissance, the Harlem Renaissance of the early 1930s. Again, this is information which is contained within the sealed files of the FBI, the Department of State, Homeland Security. But this book actually was banned. The book, The Man Who Cried I Am, by John A. Williams, because it was really a pretty apprehensive and original concept of the plan to incarcerate Negroes in the 1960s, as I said before, not being redundant, coming off of the plan that did incarcerate an entire population in this country. And I'm really saddened by how few African Americans know or even understand what the internment of the entire Japanese population in the United States was like. from 1942 until basically July, August 1945. I hope I'm giving you some additional background there.
Oh, yeah. That was kind of my concern, too, that a lot of people didn't understand what had happened back then, and then don't understand a lot of the stuff that took place even in the 60s, 1960s, with the thing. I mean, the whole thing with the, I guess, the King Alfred plan. And the life.
You're absolutely right. The King Alfred plan, which was actually a real plan. If it had not been, I say that on this program tonight, as I've said before over the years, if it had not been for the courageousness and courage of Adam Clayton Powell Jr., Democrat of New York, and William Dawson, Congressman from Chicago, Illinois, we could have found ourselves on trains and boxcars and et cetera being sent, because internment camps in the 1960s were being set up. And I'm going to give you, sir, I don't know how familiar you are with this part of the country where we're so liberal, but in 1967, there were hostilities here in the Twin Cities. The state of martial law was declared, just like they did in Charlotte the other week.
Yeah.
National Guard troops were brought in, but beyond that, what a lot of people didn't realize is that federal troops, the 101st Airborne, in fact, had been ordered into the Twin Cities. Hubert Humphrey, who was getting ready to try to run for president of the United States, was livid with what he considered to be betrayal by communist-leaning Negroes here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And they were actually on the ground getting ready to get on their aircraft. Mr. Allen certainly can understand this. He's a military man. And at the last moment, then President Johnson convinced his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, that that was not the right thing to do, particularly in that he had to be dependent upon the Negro vote. And that would not be a very good thing to do. But I can tell you this, I'm now authorized to name a specific individual who was an officer in the United States Army and was in one of the lead groups. Mr. Allen will probably recognize this name. His name was Tony Wagner, and for many years he was the executive director of Pillsbury United. Yes, Don. Yes, yes. Tony Wagner was an officer, and he later shared with me how the operation was going to go, because he wanted to let me know that my name was one of those names on the list of the first group of Negroes to be rounded up. And I've talked about this before, maybe 15 or 20 years ago. It is quite obvious that there's not an interest in this community to that extent of that what was going to be the state of emergency, if you will, and the roundup of young African-Americans, old African-Americans, anybody else that was on the list. And, in fact, the person who was in charge, I hate to do this because many of these people are now deceased, but, you know, that's not my problem. The person who was in the control center and actually was working closely with the list is a man who was well-known and liked in our community. He was a commander in the United States Navy, Dr. John Taborn. And some of this was confirmed to me by another Navy commander at the University of Syracuse at that time. That was commander of the in the United States Navy, one of the great intelligence chiefs, if you will, in the history of this country, who also confirmed the existence of the list and what was supposed to happen right here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. All of this ties in to the information provided by Congressman Powell and Congressman Dawson, who, by the way, at the time that they made sure that the information, the King Alfred plan, was made available to many of us young Negroes of that particular time, they were the only two African-Americans in the Congress of the United States. The only two.
Wow.
They were to be joined a couple years later by Diggs out of Detroit and one other out of New York City. But, yes, sir, you're absolutely correct. Quite a history behind this book, The Man Who Cried Am. As I said, it was purged, and, in fact, it wasn't until 2004 that it was allowed back in publication.
Yeah.
Any other questions, sir?
Look, you know, I have a question, Mr. Edwards. Why is every chapter titled Amsterdam? Like chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, because I got a copy of the book here, and got it from Hamel University.
I bet you
did. And it's pretty deep. It goes into detail, and you never hear anybody talking about this book and the depth and the map that it put in for young academics or readers to read it and figure out what was really going on in the society. It's even relevant today. So.
Yes, it is, and it's one of the reasons that I, as a historian and journalist and author, make reference to it in an attempt to at least keep future generations advised of the actual plan. In fact, Mr. Allen, I don't know if our caller has a copy of the book, but, you know, when you look at the afterword, page 405, Mr. Allen, you say you have the book there with you, page 405 of the book, you need to really take a look at the information. But I'll tell you one part you really need to look at, because this is where, in some regards, we were involved, quote unquote. There was a book written about a year later by an individual by the name of Riley, Mr. Riley, caller from outside of Minnesota.
Yeah.
And he talked in terms of something that many of us knew, who were the young radicals of that particular day. And his book was entitled The Purging of the Negro Community from 1960 to
1972. Ooh.
Yeah. Wow.
And he, in this book, Mr. Riley, talked in terms of the undertakings. Oops, may have been a poor choice of words, given how many African-Americans were mysteriously murdered and et cetera. But for our readers nationally and internationally, gentlemen, let me do this, and for our caller from out of state, it was Kenneth O'Reilly, and the book was entitled Racial Matters, the FBI's Secret File on Black America, 1960 to 1972.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah. And this was a footnote or afterthought by Brother John A. Williams before it appeared that he was to leave this life. Let me just say this, because these two individuals I'm getting ready to name were very instrumental also in helping the contact with Congressman Powell and Dawson. In fact, one of them actually lived here in the Twin Cities, Mr. Allen, right around the neighborhood that you were born in for a brief period of time before he moved over to St. Paul, and then he was reassigned to Richard Gibraltar Air Base in a place called Kansas City, Missouri. And that was Colonel Charles E. McGee, United States Air Force, retired/now deceased. He reflected some of his contacts and et cetera in a book published in 1999, and he talked in terms of a very good friend and senior colonel by the name of Henry B. Perry. Colonel Perry, a B-52, well, first of all, he was a fighter pilot with the 332 Tuskegee Group. He later became a B-52 nuclear carrying aircraft. What my relationship with them was, I'm not at liberty to discuss, but they were of great facilitation and help in helping us make the contact in the mid-1960s to be given the necessary information that we were able to carry out onto the platform, if you will, into the streets, and allows a individual such as myself to have a very, very understanding, or a great understanding of just how dangerous a situation we are in right now in Black America.
Mm.
Yeah. So we're talking about people of significant stature, particular Colonel Perry, who, as I said, was a B-52 bomber pilot of aircraft that carried nuclear weapons, which meant, sir, and Mr. Allen, that he had the highest of security clearance. And I was just very blessed and very lucky. And then at the University of of Syracuse, that is one of the reasons why I have entrusted my archives to the University of Rochester in New York, if you will. Yeah. Yeah. If Mr. Allen, my associate, has a copy, hell of a book. But for people that really understand how dangerous things are out here, it will make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. Sir, any more questions for us?
Oh, no. I was just saying, for a lot of people who don't believe a lot of this stuff is actually going on, all you have to do is, there are things like the McCarran Act and stuff like that in the 1950s. There's the Church Committee that I believe that was the mid-1970s, I believe it was, the Church
That's
Committee.
That's correct.
It was named for
a senator from Oregon, the state of Oregon, Senator Frank Church. Yes, sir. Surprised a lot of people when they found out what the Church Committee was recommending. But go ahead, sir. Your history is important.
Yeah, it's just amazing that there's some people out there who just don't believe that there was actually an internment of Japanese even. But there's so much information out there, if they actually go looking for it, they can see it now. But it's amazing what the government has done over the years, everything from overthrowing governments to assassinations and everything else over the years. So,
let me say this to you, and any questions you may have, even Mr. Allen.
Right.
A lot of people really tried to keep this suppressed, and maybe probably even in, more so in the 1950s and 60s, because the martial law administrator who was appointed by then President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of the greatest libertarians and et cetera in the history of this country, according to what we are told as African Americans. I know his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, was a great fighter for the Negro, if you will. I'm not sure her husband was necessarily that fond of her relationship with black people, particularly Mary McLeod Bethune.
Yeah.
But you must always remember, sir, you sound like a much younger man than myself and probably more in the age group of Mr. Allen, is that the man who was appointed martial law administrator and who took every piece of property, assets, and et cetera that the entire Japanese-American population of this nation had in their possession, which in same-time dollars now would probably be $8 to $9 billion, was later to become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, and his name is a part of Brown versus Topeka, the late, obviously late, Earl Warren, former governor of California. It is. I would suggest this to all of us that, we already have. You may want to go into your computers and take a look at the memoirs of Earl Warren as he approached the end of his life, writing about those things that he did. And it's interesting the reflections he made about that he would always carry with him what he did to Japanese Americans. You got to remember, the same kind of laws were not imposed upon Italians and Germans and those who were fifth columnists and et cetera, gentlemen, in this country. In other words, it was a color issue. And for I think how we got started on this, and it is a part of my column that comes out tomorrow, is that contrary to what people would like to think, it was based on the color of the skin of the Japanese, of the Nishi, Japanese Americans, and et cetera. And it's really also a part of the consideration that came about with regards to the dropping of two hydrogen bombs on the island of Japan to send a message that the United States was prepared to obliterate the island of Japan and all of its people. But what people don't discuss is what the Japanese had uncovered back in 1922 and 23 about the United States of America and the plan that was in place because of the racial conflict that was going on in this country in that period right after the First World War. That's when we had some of the greatest violence after slavery against the sons and daughters of the Negro. And people don't like to talk about that. They pretend they don't know anything about it. And the history is there. But if you get a chance, sir, whoever you are, wherever you're at, you may want to call up the memoirs of the late Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Earl Warren, who was the administrator, the martial law administrator of the United States of America.
Oh, yeah. And actually, that's one of the reasons I think that Dwight Eisenhower wanted him as on the Supreme Court, was because he wasn't going to further any more. They thought, anyway, he wasn't going to further any civil rights advances in the United States. And, of course, they got tricked with that. And,
yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That was
I think it was Justice Warren's wife who later in some kind of, it was published, I think, by Collier's Magazine. Used to be a magazine that was around in America back in those days, disappeared like life and time and everything else.
Yeah.
It was his wife who apparently, Chief Justice, soon to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and as you said, sir, you've done your historical research, Dwight Eisenhower felt that he would be a safe Chief Justice. But it was his wife, it was Justice Warren's wife, who told him that he needed to make peace with God.
And
do the right thing. And that's how actually we came about. And sometimes for those that take the time, read the memoirs also of later to be Justice of the Supreme Court, the beloved Thurgood Marshall.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Appreciate
you
calling.
Thank
you.
Thank you very much. All right.
Bye-bye. And Mr.
Edwards,
we have
we got any calls or whatever?
Yeah.
Lines open. Go ahead, man.
You're live on the air, caller. Who's calling? Where are you calling from?
Gentlemen, this is
yes,
hello. This is Mr. M from Palatial Estate, somewhere in Minneapolis.
Oh, Mr. M, how you doing, sir? Okay,
good, right. Good. Oh,
now, we're not going to intern you. We're not going to send you down to that old camp that we had down there on the Minnesota River for those little yellow people. We're not going to send your people down there. You know, folks are saying that, and that's, you know, we wouldn't violate your constitutional rights.
This has been almost a frightening conversation, really, a historical conversation. You know, it was so frightening that when the name John A. Williams and the book, man, my phone went, my computer, everything went dead. I was disconnected from the computer.
You've got to be kidding him.
I was disconnected. For the last 10 minutes, I've been totally disconnected. I mean, they've got so heavy, I thought I didn't know if I was under any kind of surveillance or watch.
Are, sir. Or you probably would have been. It'd be interesting to see how many other people ran into those kind of electronic problems. As I said before, this is a book that I got one of the first copies when it came out back in, and I made a mistake and I lost it about 4 or 5 years ago. Man, it took me almost 20 years to acquire. In fact, the copy that I acquired, Mr. Allen, I don't know where you got yours, and I don't need to have you tell me over the air, but I had to actually ask, I had to actually send all the way to London, England, to get the copy that I currently have had now in my possession for about a decade.
Well, it's really shows the lengths of suppression of what's kind of going on. I mean, you bringing up the name of the Earl Warren. I think back to the Warren Commission and the death of John Kennedy and how that was supposedly investigated by the Warren Commission and all these names, they continue to swirl around. It's very, 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 our history, and only, really this program really continues to just bring that out and hopefully opens the eyes of people, especially with so much going on in our world now with this election, with, Mr. Kaepernick, he continues to keep his one man, which apparently is, I did see that there were some individuals at the University of Nebraska that did some you know.
Actually, sir, we have not talked about it. Haven't found necessarily the right slot. You have to understand that some high school athletes here, not any college and not any pros, though I think the Lynx, who played tonight, as I understand it, would have probably done it, carry out a kneel down in support. And actually, it first came out at North High School. In fact, they were going to try to punish North High School, but their coaches, particularly led by Charles Adams III, and his father, Charles Adams II, Sergeant Charles Adams, fought a hell of a battle, had a hell of a strategy, and when their next game came up, which was a game in Cameron, Wisconsin, against Ashland, Wisconsin, who came down and North High School went over, and I would be remiss if I did not praise how North High School, their principal, Miss Berry, handled this very well, because there was discussion about not allowing North to play, but then there began to be discussion that there was going to be problems in Cameron, Wisconsin, where the game was held, that there were certain right-wing factions that were prepared to make a statement and have them some monkey meat, you know what that means. Boy, everything went well. That was two Fridays ago, if you will, and so North High School is to be commended for the way that they handled the situation and the young men. There were actually nine in the game at Brooklyn Center, which was the week before the game against Ashland, Wisconsin. Nine young African-Americans took their knee. But what kind of messed everything up, gentlemen, was that same Friday that they were on their way to play the game in Wisconsin, the entire volleyball squad of South High School took their knee. And, of course, the composition was nine young white women and five women of color.
Well, that's very, very interesting. You know, and in the Nebraska situation, as I understand, one of the individuals, I guess you call them the Board of Regents or one of the higher-ups of the institution, said, you know, well, those individual football players that sat down, well, we don't need them. Why don't they just forfeit their scholarship? We can just send them on their way. We don't need them. Came very out very strongly in defiance of their act. But,
okay.
I think it was very interesting what you just said about the North. I mean, one of the things that I haven't seen, at least on the Kaepernick side, is I haven't seen any Caucasian people get behind this.
No,
I'm just saying, just from what I've observed. Now,
there's no Caucasian players that have joined him. A couple brothers have joined him, but it's been very weak. And people have been talking about it, and I noticed ever since Charlotte. Now, you got to realize, gentlemen, we haven't talked about what happened on Sunday. I mean, everybody's pumped up that the Vikings defeated Carolina, et cetera. It was quite clear to me, gentlemen, that Cam Newton, who is a very strong-minded, strong-willed brother, that his mind and his heart was not in that game Sunday. Now, I'd like to ask your observation, Em, because I know you watch sports. Now, my associate, Mr. Allen, don't be fooling around with no sports, so I'm glad you called, because I'd like to ask you your observation of Cam Newton's whole disposition and his mood, that he really wasn't into the game. And by the way, gentlemen, have you noticed we haven't heard any more from Charlotte, North Carolina?
I will have to co-sign that comment. I mean, I think before the game and leading up to it, you know, he tried to make some statements, and it was like every statement that he made, he was jumped on.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that he tried to say, everything he said, he was just jumped on. So by the time of the game, you know, he's in the city, there was protesters outside, and yes, I definitely believe it was a huge distraction for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got these guys bearing down on him, and you have to really have your – we've all seen what type of player that young man is. I mean, that's –
Absolutely, sir.
What we saw on that Sunday was not him anywhere near his capabilities. And I think the stress of what's – you know, I mean, I think a lot of it was put on him for some – whatever reason, whatever the dynamics of race in this country is very – see, it's very complicated. It's a very complicated kind of situation. But on the one hand, it's simple. okay? They're things that just shouldn't have happened. But because they have, and with so much at stake now, you know, with your TV, your money, your contracts, your endorsements, when you get at that level, I mean, it becomes a very complicated type thing to really sort through. I mean, I've talked to an individual today who felt that, you know, well he's already made his point. So why
about Cam Newton or Colin Kaepernick?
About Colin Kaepernick. He's already made his point, so why continue with this? I mean, he's only hurting,
himself. My man Shaq O'Neal said that. I really was surprised disappointed by Shaq. It seems to be that's the party line that was being insisted upon, first of all, by the networks and then by the teams themselves and then by so many of the agents of these many athletes who the majority of these agents are white, if you will. And that's the reason I raised the question about Cam. But also I think it'd be good at this point, Mr. Allen, we still got 15 minutes and we have him here with us. What is your take of what happened in Charlotte? And I have to say, for my listening audience, our listening audience, I am so proud of the mother, the mother of the children, but the wife of the deceased, because she pulled a fast one on them, and she made a fool out of everybody, including, unfortunately, the young black chief and et cetera, with that video. I have been fascinated by the silence where everybody concentrates on the debate and the presidential piece and et cetera. And there's really, gentlemen, been nothing spoken and written about at all, other than saying that the family said, well, it's inconclusive and et cetera. The picture that the wife took of her husband being killed. Oh, by the way, another black man killed today. We're beginning to see a killing almost every week of black men now, aren't we?
Jeez.
Another killing outside of San Diego.
Every 26 hours.
British, I don't know what kind of gun they thought he had in his hand. But, Em, what was your take on the video that the wife took?
Well, I thought it was very conclusive. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was there for the world to see. I mean, they killed a man. I mean, I don't.
And dropped a gun and planted a gun.
And it looks like they planted a gun. I mean, that's you know, and they were all standing around kind of so nonchalantly, like, you know.
Right.
It's like they were kind of just looking around and surveying to see who could be watching them. I mean, they had guilty looks on their face as they stood around to see what, and they weren't moving fast. You know, they weren't trying to dress his wounds. They weren't trying to do anything. I mean,
he was
very
dead already. That's why the wife.
Yeah.
She asked a heck of a question in her last statement that was recorded when she said, "Did you call an ambulance?" He looked at her like she's crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing, gentlemen, that happened last night in the town, a little suburb right outside of San Diego. They shot your brother down. They just left him laying there bleeding to death. And God knows the same thing happened in Tulsa. But Mr. Allen, what is your observation about what happened in Tulsa? Let's get you in on this. What is your observation about what happened in Tulsa as opposed to what didn't happen in Charlotte?
I think that looking at in comparison and contrasting between both of them, Tulsa was conclusive. The guy did not have a weapon, and it was a murder. It was a point blank, you know, shooting murder. Because I remember, Mr. Edwards, last week we talked about this a little bit, because I found that story in Southern California where they beanbagged a guy that was actually shooting at police and arrested him because he was in an ambulance.
White man.
Yeah, and so. I've been watching the social networks, social media networks, and especially a lot of these radio personalities who are saying that, you know, they're pulling up numbers from the different institutes, research institutes, saying that, you know, more white men are shot by police than black men.
Right.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of that, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. Now, the day before the Tulsa incident, there was six Hispanic men killed by police.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking at two ways. We're not hearing, Mr. Edwards, in the same magnitude about the killings of the Hispanic and the other Asian folks by police, but the media is using this in some kind of way to twist the narrative. This is a problem, number one, but why be selective? If they're killing all brown people equally, at least one every 26 hours, either brown, red, or yellow.
That's what the statistical data is saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we getting that information? Why are we only getting the black information, which is just as important as all the rest of the information? But what is
good
the media
point.
Trying to set up in this country between the white and the black?
Yeah, well, I think
so,
they've set it in place, and as I said, gentlemen, just a couple minutes ago, from my own perspective and point of view, but, you know, we're lucky and blessed to have a platform to talk to more people than just two guys on the corner. We're averaging now what's happened, and this escalation as we move closer and closer to the voting date in November, we're seeing more and more people of color, and particularly African Americans, are being killed now by the police on an average of a little over one a week. Would you concur with that observation, sir?
I would. And, you know, and I don't know, you know, how we stem the tide. I mean, this is the thing. It just seems to continue to escalate. You know, you have these things, and then they're blown up on television, and you're having your, you know, protests. But then they keep coming, and it seems like the effort to elucidate this and bring it out becomes watered down because it just keeps happening.
Yes.
You know, because
yeah.
It just keeps happening. So, you know, you have this big, and you think you're making an impact, and people are listening to you and hearing, but then it just keeps happening.
That's right. I thought it was interesting a couple of younger African-Americans, particularly one young brother who's a former police officer in Chicago who heads up an organization, and I saw him get very upset when a white retired New York City police detective tried to clown with regards to the authenticity of the wife and what she had done. I repeat again, I thought that hers was a turning point as it pertains to making a fool out of the narrative that was coming out of North Carolina and really caused the governor, who I watched the press conference of the governor, and when you talk in terms of indifference, McCoy, I mean, you're talking in terms of a redneck. I mean, he was so out of it that and his chief of staff was standing at least, you know, just 3 feet away from him. He would not talk about that video. He went to talking about the floods. He went to talking about fishing. He went to talking about the football game, you know. And I said, wow, what a discussion on something that is shaking the foundation of that state. But the young former black officer out of Chicago says something that I can only speak for myself, gentlemen. You know, speak, obviously, and that's what it's all about. But I just think that, you know, what is happening is that old white senator, or actually congressman, who caught everybody off guard by saying, well, Negroes just hate us.
Oh, boy.
They just hate white people. And that's the bottom line. And I thought, okay, so what, you love us? And so let me ask this question. Mr. Allen, we have enough time left here, about 5 minutes. Why does no one ever, gentlemen, I want both of y'all now, if I'm off base, you come after me. Why do we never talk about who radicalized white folks in their hatred for black people? Oops. Is that not a part of radicalization?
Boy, you know.
I mean, I asked that question again.
Yes,
I've asked it in my column. Why do we not talk about who in the hell radicalized white America to hate us so much and to so violate us as human beings? Why don't we talk about radicalization?
Boy, heck of a point. But, you know, on the flip side of that, you know, white folks really need to be glad aren't radicalized. that we don't look at treating them like they've treated us over the years. I mean, I tell you, since my trip to Africa and going back into those libraries and those books and seeing all of those things of the atrocities of things that I couldn't even think of to do to people.
Right.
I couldn't even think to do another human being like that. It wouldn't even cross my mind to do that. And so, they need to really be, actually, I guess they need to get on their knees and be thankful that we are not like they are.
Mr. Allen, do you concur? Have you ever given any thought, Mr. Allen, to why we don't discuss the radicalization of white people against the freedom and the safety of African Americans?
Yeah,
have I made a good point,
gentlemen? You've made a great point. You've made a compelling point, argument. Why? What's going to happen? One of those things in the strategy is we don't control black folks. We don't control identity. You know, NASA got that under control. And as long as the historical assumptions are controlled by a element that labels anything black as bad, you know, everything bad, black is black ice, black plane, black rat.
Like the pilot in the helicopter in Tulsa when he said,
that's
one bad dude. Yeah,
that's
right.
One bad dude, you know. You know, you're talking about the black dude, black man. That's one bad dude, you know. Anything bad
what he was
is
doing.
Black. And until we get away from that particular identification marker, you know, which we can't get away from because no one's discussing white America's radicalization.
I'm
going to
encourage
y'all
to use that as a reference point. I like that, Mr. Al.
And so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean that just comes into play. I remember there's a guy named Sam Embo. He's a professor, and he says, you know what? I have trouble celebrating Black History Month. And we go, why, Dr. Embo? He says, well, he says, I'm black. I've been black all my life. I'm black 24/7, 365 days a year. And history is all in these great books, but they don't treat us the same way as they do the white historical relics. And so when Black History Month come along, I get invited. He said, I get invited to all these things, and I have to turn them down because I can't be a hypocrite. And then he went in, he says, you know, and he asked the whole class, yellow, red, black, and white people. He says, what's the first memory of Africa? And Mr. Edwards, I had to think about it.
Not Tarzan. Not Tarzan. Don't tell me Tarzan.
Oh! I have to tell you.
I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Jane and Cheetah, when we used to watch it on Saturday afternoon in St. Paul on 1088 North Dale Street in 1966. That was the show. Tarzan was coming on because he could talk to all the people.
Wana.
He was
Wana.
But Wana.
Up Mangani. Pacey. Yeah, and you know he whooped all the Negroes, even though he was a little guy, you know he whooped 10 or 20 of them at a time and sent them on the way. No one was messing with that white queen up in the treehouse.
That's right.
Okay,
that's
ever.
Right. That's right.
And so that
Tarzan would even defeat gorillas. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Talk
I
him down.
You
could talk him down. He could talk him down.
Talk him down.
The gorillas were like, oh, man, we can't mess with you, you know. And Tarzan was the king and the beater on anything black. And that, you know, Conrad, Robert Heart of Darkness, he wrote that book. You know, the Dutch sailor that went through Africa that, you know, would talk about the black man in loincloth, dirty, scoundrel, evil, had these eyes that, you know, just, and it went through history like that for a very long time. And the identity created, you know, how are we going to get changed past the historical assumptions? Because it's still a part of everyday life where we have to go out the house and decide what mask we're going to pull out of the closet.
Yeah.
You know?
But let me just say this, because I know we're down to the last minute and a half, because folks need to know that there are real hard feelings by many of us who are black. And M can understand this because he and I basically, it appears, are the same generation. I saw my first Tarzan movie, M, in 1948 as a little young Negro child. And a couple things came to mind. It's just like the whole thing about shooting up all the Indians and, you know, the white man's gun was never empty. You know what I'm saying? But I thought for a long time, really, and I admit to this as an African-American, I thought that after 4,000 years or so in the jungles, that the black Africans had never learned how to swing on a tree limb or swim in the water.
Yeah.
But that this white man, Tarzan, had come along and had achieved all of that within 12, 14, or 15 years in the jungle. Gentlemen, I just had to say that because I've been thinking about it for years. Want to thank you,
Thank everybody. Yep. Thank you. All thank you for listening. Right. We'll be back next week.
All right. It's too low to see.